Well, I want to thank you again for coming back tonight, and kind of a difficult time to speak and also to keep you awake, so we're going to try to make this as educational and entertaining and as succinct as possible. But I want to talk to you tonight a little bit about evolution. We've kind of been on an apologetics theme this day or this weekend, and by apologetics we simply mean defending the faith. To apologize in a classical sense simply means to put out proofs that defend the faith of Jesus Christ. And, you know, really when we think about evolution, of course, it's all around us. In fact, for those of you in college or high school, you probably encounter this much more than those who are older do. Although, if you watch TV, if you watch the Discovery Channel, the History Channel, PBS, or any of those other scientific channels, you're going to be fed either covertly or overtly many times the theory of evolution. And, you know, today in our world, we are led to believe that if you don't believe in evolution, really there's something wrong with you. Well, I think when we look at evolution, first of all, and we'll notice this a little bit more later on, it's not that Christians don't believe in evolution per se. There is a certain type of evolution that is compatible with the Word of God. But the evolution, the type where man supposedly evolved from a lower form, is not compatible with the Word of God. And as we will see, really in reality, it's not even proven in the world at large scientifically. In fact, it is a theory, and I realize today that the term theory has been tweaked, and folks will get you to believe now that theory means basically fact. They've changed the definitions on us. But in reality, evolution is not a fact. It's really a modern-day fairy tale. You know, as you look back over culture and you look back over history, man has always had his theories of origin. Whether it was the ancient Greeks who believed in gods and goddesses and all of these paganism, there has always been these theories of how man came into being. And they've always been quite fanciful. And I believe that even though, again, it's more sophisticated today, we have, again, a very fanciful theory that's being purported as truth that man evolved from a lower type of life. Now, first of all, you know, the Bible doesn't say a lot about the existence of God and proving His existence. In fact, it's pretty much maintained in the Scriptures from the first verses that God is. It's an assumed fact. Now, why would that be? Well, because the evidence of God is all around us. We have creation. We have order in the universe. And obviously, any rational mind is not going to assume that all of that occurred by chance. And so then, as the Apostle Paul says, he says, "For the invisible things of Him," speaking of God, "are since the creation of the world are clearly seen, being perceived through the things that are made, even His everlasting power and divinity, that they may be without excuse." In other words, in reality, even though we may spend time today combating the theory of evolution, there's really no necessity or incumbency upon us to combat it, because those who believe it are without excuse. That's because God has built into His system all things we need to at least point us toward a Creator. Now, tonight, I want to notice some points that we want to look at, just like we did this morning. First of all, we want to notice a little bit about science and the Bible. Are the two compatible? Number two, something that I call the intimidation factor. Number three, the seduction factor. Number four, what is evolution? Number five, some problems with evolution. Is there any evidence for God? Number six, and number seven, what would it be like with life without God? Well, these are some things we want to look at. And so, first of all, what about science and the Bible? You know, there was a time when it was readily recognized and believed that science, true science, something that was observable and replicatable, was not at all in contradiction to the Bible. And, of course, now folks tell us that science teaches one thing and the Bible teaches another. Now, it is true that theories in the scientific world may teach something differently than the Bible. But true science does not contradict the Word of God. Why? Because true science is based upon what you can observe, you can quantify, and you can then study it and even replicate it. Well, of course, evolution can't be done with any of those things. You can't see evolution, at least not the type of evolution we're going to be combating today. You can't replicate it. And of course, the millions of years ago when this supposedly took place, no one was around. And so again, when we look at science, I think we have to be careful that we're defining science in the true classical sense of the word. True science does not contradict religion. Now, it is true that sometimes religious theories also come and go. You know, some of the things that were taught back in the Middle Ages, for example, about the earth being flat, were, as religious theories go, were being taught as if it was gospel truth. And of course, it was even connected with various religious organizations, such as the church, back at that period of time. But true religion does not contradict true science. You can be a scientist today, I believe, and be a Christian without those things coming into conflict. Where the conflict arises is where one or both are wrong. And by the way, the theories, again, that we believe today in science will in 50 years change. You know, sometimes I hear a lot of hype about global warming and about this theory or this issue or that issue. Give it 50 years, all of the theories will have changed, all of the paradigms will have shifted, and folks will no longer believe what they believe today. That is the nature of science. That is the nature of the scientific community. Also in religion. That's the reason we hold so firmly to the infallible, unchangeable Word of God. When you leave the Word of God, you also can have all kinds of changes in theology. And sometimes, in fact, many times, theology and science come into conflict because one or both are wrong. Now, you know, Paul warned Timothy, told him to be careful about knowledge or science, as perhaps the old King James says. He says, "O Timothy, guard what is committed to your trust. Avoid the profane and idle babblings and contradictions of what is falsely called knowledge." Now, you know, we want our kids to go to school. We want them to go to college or to a trade school or get training on the job, whatever. And we want them to get knowledge because we have been taught, and rightly so, that knowledge is power. And that knowledge then will allow us to have a job and have some skill that we can sell. But we need to be careful that not all knowledge, of course, is something we accept. There are many things on the college level, for example, or in the educational system that are patently false that folks would have you believe. In fact, I know for a fact that there are professors in colleges whose main goal is not to teach their subject, but to shake your faith. You get all these impressionable minds in college. And of course, you've got these professors standing up there with their PhD and a whole alphabet soup behind their name. And they intimidate, purposely at times, these young minds who are coming out of family backgrounds where maybe the Bible is viewed as the Word of God. Well, again, young people, you may not be able to explain everything you believe. You may not be able to stand up in a class and embarrass the professor. That shouldn't be your goal anyway. But don't give up your beliefs just because someone who has been skilled and schooled under a pagan institution or under a false pretense of knowledge comes and denies what you believe in God. Again, hold on to what you can know. Hold on to what you do know. And don't focus on your doubts. I guarantee you that every preacher, if he's honest, will tell you he still has doubts even after preaching for 50 or 60 years. There are things that you just have to accept on faith. But don't give up what you can know and do know and can prove by the Word of God for theories or things that perhaps can never be known. Well, you know, many of the greatest scientists of the post-thousand years have actually been Christians. And I'm going to use that term a little bit on the loose side for this study. But they've been people, in other words, who believe the Bible. They have been creationists. In fact, in reality, Christianity has been the driving force behind Western civilization and science itself. Now, let's think about this. Science says, true science says, that things can be observed, they can be quantified, you can take notes and research them, and you can verify those results by doing it over and over again. In other words, there is a systematic order that is required for true science to occur. Well, of course, Christianity demands a systematic order as well. We believe that God is the orderer. He is the one that places the system of the cosmos, and it is the Christian worldview that the stars and the moon and the world functions according to the divine plan of God that even allows us then to assume that we can study other things in the universe as well. And again, the Christian worldview, I believe, gave impetus and birth to modern science. You know, in Psalm 19, David says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork." In other words, those ancients who would go out and look up into the sky and developed all the celestial systems and charts that we use today, they did that because they knew there was order, and they knew that today when the moon comes up here, it's going to come up there tomorrow, and so on and so forth. So, again, Christianity and science are certainly compatible to one another. Many of the greatest scientists, men that today we view as being really the undergird of the scientific methods and theories, were Christians or men who believed in the Bible. Leonardo da Vinci, very famous Renaissance man who was an author and a painter and a scientist, an inventor. He considered himself a believer in Christianity. Galileo, who was the inventor of the scientific method as we know it today, was a believer in the Christian system. Sir Isaac Newton, we talked about him earlier in this meeting. The law of gravity, he identified and quantified the law of gravity. Every one of these men, and literally hundreds more, you could go down the list. In fact, there are whole books written about the lives of these Christian men and women who are scientists. They believed in God. They believed in the veracity of Scripture. They believed in the Bible. They believed in Jesus Christ. Science as is not now, nor has it ever been, incompatible with the will of God. At least not scientifically. Now, politically, yes. Today, it is very politically incorrect. If you're in the scientific community, or any kind of really scientific field, to espouse God and His Word. But nonetheless, you're in good company tonight if you look back to some of the great scientists of the modern era and realize they were Christians. Well, here's really the question. You know, when we think about science, you know, many scientists are what we call materialists. And because they can't see something, they then claim that spirituality doesn't exist. Now again, the real question is this. Is the material universe all that exists? Because, you know, what we believe today as Christians is that there is a material universe, that there is, a cosmos that circulates and that has all these components, and that there's a spiritual realm as well. Now, you know, the world today, the scientific world, would have you believe in most part, and really most people in culture too, that the material world is all that exists. Therefore, they deny angels, they deny the afterlife, they deny heaven, hell, God. Anything they can't quantify, they say doesn't exist. But you know, that doesn't even make sense. Because you know, there are a lot of things, even in our own lives, that we can't quantify, but yet we know exists. You know, if you're married, you love your spouse, hopefully. Can you quantify that? No. Does love exist? Yes. Is it tangible? No. Now, it may manifest itself in tangible ways, but you see, we readily recognize that there are things that are outside of the material universe. And so if you start with the basis that everything has to be in the material universe to exist or to be real, then we've got a real problem. What about consciousness? You know, we're conscious here tonight, some more than others, because some of us are wanting that nap. But, you know, consciousness is something we can't quantify. You can't put it on a chart and study it necessarily, but yet we know it exists. And so, again, let's not fall into this trap like the materialists do, that unless we can see it, touch it, taste it, or smell it, or whatever, that it doesn't exist. There are, again, things that exist, such as God, which we cannot necessarily quantify. Now, point number two, the intimidation factor. I think this is really important, especially again for you young people who are in school. Now when you get old like us and you go and read your books and you study at home and all that, there's not much intimidation. You kind of decide what you want to believe on your own. But now in school, folks are pressuring you, your peers, your professors, even the programs that you watch on TV, they're all pressuring you and intimidating you to say, hey, there is no God. Or, hey, the Bible is not true. And basically, here's what they're saying. They're saying, unless you're a scientist, you're too stupid to understand. Unless you think that's an overstatement, let me read you a quote from Richard Dawkins. Now, I don't know if any of you know who Richard Dawkins is. Richard Dawkins has had several best-selling books out in recent years. He is literally the poster child for evolution. He is rabid atheist against all belief. He does not even acknowledge agnosticism, which he says is a wimp out. He says he knows and can prove there is no God. And he has gone on many TV shows. In fact, you remember that Ben Stein movie, you know, that interviewed him. I saw him the other night on Larry King Live. No, it's not on Larry King, it's not on the talk show. But anyway, he is a rabid person against all religion. He believes it is child abuse to teach your children any kind of faith system in the home. But here's what he said. And by the way, he has a lot of followers. He said, it's absolutely safe to say that if you meet someone who claims not to believe in evolution, and by the way, he's talking about full-blown evolution here, it is safe to say that person is either ignorant, stupid, or insane. You see, what he's doing here is he's really throwing out the intimidation factor. He's saying, listen, the community of scientists, who are really, in reality, the clergy of our culture, if they say it, then you're stupid or dumb or don't understand, you're ignorant if you don't understand the truth that they are teaching. And you know, the problem with that is, first of all, that's intimidation. That's propaganda. But second of all, it is not true that all scientists believe in evolution. There are many scientists who, even if they're not Christians, and by the way, there are non-Christian scientists who challenge the current theories of evolution and thinking about how the universe came to be. They would have you believe that the truth that they're preaching in their universities, which are their churches, is a monolithic truth that cannot be at all debunked. That's not even true amongst their own midst. When you read their writings, there are different professors who, when in moments of honesty, come out, will even challenge their own peers' conclusions. But Richard Dawkins, he's a mess. And keep in mind that this is the attitude you're up against when you challenge the current point of evolution. You know, in our culture today, there are two very important PCs. One's your personal computer. You can't go anywhere without that. And the other is, unfortunately, being politically correct. And today, if you're going to be politically correct, you have got to buy into the system of science that's being sold. Whether it is global warming, whether it's evolution, whether it's whatever, you need to buy into it. Otherwise, you are not politically correct, and you're considered to be a little out of touch. Well, again, don't let them make you think, that there is a monolithic body of truth out there to which everyone ascribes, because it is simply not true. In fact, again, the more you read, the more you study, the more ideas you will find that disagree with the modern trends that go through the media. But you know, one of the things that I want us as parents and grandparents to think about is not only is there an intimidation factor, but there is a seduction factor as well. You know, one of the things, and you can call it a conspiracy theory. I'm not big on conspiracy theories, although I think they're humorous. But one of the things that I think I see out there, and again, whether it's a conspiracy theory or just the way things fall out, I don't know, but they want to seduce your kids from a very young age. In fact, if you go to National Geographic, if you go to any of those scientific websites, you will see that they have their own kids section or kids website where they teach and indoctrinate the theory of evolution. And they make it very interesting and very fun. And again, the point is to get these kids young and begin to subtly, or not so subtly, indoctrinate them into the theory that man evolved from a lower form of being. And they do this in so many ways. Dinosaurs. We'll talk about those in a minute, a little bit more. But you know, what kid is not enthralled with dinosaurs? I was. And you are too, probably. You know, these bigger-than-life creations, these bigger-than-life lizards that roamed the earth supposedly, you know, 30 million years ago? Who's not excited about that? And so then they draw us in. By the way, I do believe in dinosaurs. We'll talk about that in a moment. But that's one of the ways that they encapsulate the imaginations of our kids. Movies. Movies like Jurassic Park. There are other movies too, but that one was so big back about 10 years ago. Jurassic Park, you remember where the guy was able to extract the DNA from a mosquito that had been encased in amber, and he was able on this island to produce new dinosaurs. And of course, the whole experiment got out of control because life will find a way. Well, that movie was incredible. It was fun to watch. There were, I think, three of them. And again, it was kind of, you know, mind candy, a little sci-fi there. But it sort of draws you in and begins to let you let down your guard about this whole idea that this occurred millions of years ago with the dinosaur on the earth. School, textbooks, it's everywhere. unless you homeschool, which some of you do, and I did with my son for a few years, and even sometimes, depending on what you use, you'll find allusions to it. Schools indoctrinate our kids to evolution. Museums. Go right over here to St. Louis to the museum, the big zoo, and you will find when you go in, at least unless they've changed it, a shrine to Lucy. Lucy was that bipedal type, hominid that they hominoid, whatever they call it, that supposedly was an ancestor of mankind millions of years ago. There was a shrine to her. You know, they've got her bones up there, or at least a mock-up of the bones. It's indoctrinated. It's everywhere. Science channels, news channels, Smithsonian Magazine, you name it. It is there. And then, of course, the TV and educational channels as well. Well, let me just quote a couple of textbooks in case you think I'm just making this up. This is everywhere. Let me look Holt and Reinhardt and Winston, kind of a popular textbook producer. Visualizing Life, 1998. I realize that's getting about 10 years old now. But it says, look at this. Look closely at your hand. You have five flexible fingers. Animals with five flexible fingers are called primates. So far, that's true. Monkeys, apes, and humans are examples of primates. So far, so good. Primates most likely evolved from small insect-eating rodent-like mammals that lived about 60 million years ago. Now, you see what we've done here? And you'll find this over and over. Be a discerning reader. Be a discerning listener. We have combined some truth, some things that are verifiable, with some things that cannot be proved at all. And we're going to pass the whole thing off as truth. Now notice this, Miller and Levine, Biology, 2000. But all researchers agree, really? Every researcher? No, that again is false logic. But all researchers agree on certain basic facts. Really? Facts? No, they're theories. We know, for example, that humans evolved from ancestors we share with other living primates such as chimpanzees and apes. Now we only know that because people have told us that's true. But there is no empirical evidence to prove that. And so then, here again, amongst these textbooks are these thoughts and things sort of inculcated into the content which our kids have to cipher through. You know, my son is in a farm school over at UMKC, and he was saying, Dad, the tests are crazy. Because he said, sometimes they will give you two choices that you have to pair off against each other, and you have to assume that evolution, organic evolution, is true before you can even answer the question. He said, you know, really, you're kind of up against a no-win situation sometimes, and these are scientific classes, where evolution should have nothing to do with, feeding somebody some penicillin pills. But anyway, the point is your tax dollars are at work. Society and culture is indeed against you when it comes to truth. Well, let's talk a little bit about what is evolution. We've sort of condemned it, but what is it? You know, it may be a surprise that not all evolution is unscriptural. I believe that there is at least one type of evolution that is very much in accord with the Word of God. But it's not the type of evolution that we've been reading about in textbooks or that you hear about on the news. Now, there are two types. I don't want to get too in-depth in this because of the time element. But first of all, there is microevolution. Now, micro means small. Like, for instance, we have a microscope that we look through to see slides of cells. We look at small things. And there is something called microevolution. Microevolution is small changes within a species. In other words, for example, when you look at dogs, let's use that example. Today, there are many types of dogs. There are dogs with long legs and short legs and long tails and short tails and fluffy hair and straight hair. There are dogs that have been bred, to be able to chase a rat into a hole. In fact, Clint and I were out visiting yesterday. We saw an animal we think was a cross between a dog and a squirrel. Because it was about this tall and about this long, had a tail about this long, and I think it was a wiener dog, but anyway, it looked like a cross between a dog and a squirrel. But the point is it was still a dog. And that's what you have in microevolution. You have small changes in a species, but it's still that species. You know, as humans, we have different colorations in our skin, we have different sizes. You know, today we're taller on average than we were maybe 100 years ago, and probably heavier too. But the point is that's microevolution. Either that or too many Big Macs. But anyway, it's microevolution because there are small changes, but we're still humans. Now, that's not the type of evolution we have a problem with. And that's also not the type of evolution that your school systems are trying to shove down your throat. The type they're trying to shove down your throat is what we call macroevolution. Macro is where one species changes, supposedly, to a whole nother unique species. It's like Frank Peretti called it you to you by way of the zoo, is what he said. In other words, it changes from one species to another distinct species. And, you know, that's the type of evolution that there is no evidence for. That's the type of evolution that I believe is patently false, and yet that's what's being taught. Now, why would that be taught? Why would scientists, if they're truly interested in science, teach that? Well, number one, they're coming at things from a bias. We all do. We have to understand our own biases. But number two, macroevolution says that in reality, we are getting better. We are moving up the chain. We are getting more self-actualized and becoming our own God. Sounds a lot like Genesis 3:5. Satan appeared to Eve and said, in the day that you eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you will become like God, knowing good and evil. That's exactly what secular humanism and secular evolution is trying to tell us we are becoming. That in spite of the fact that we have wars and rumors of wars and pestilence and all kinds of problems in our world, we're actually becoming better. Really? I don't think so. But let's move right along. Here's what one of the major universities says about evolution. This is from their website. You can look it up if you so desire. This is from Berkeley. Now, Berkeley, again, is not your bastion of conservatism. I'll admit that. Berkeley was when in the 60s a lot of stuff took place. But here's what they say. The central idea of biological evolution, this is the type of evolution we're talking about, not the micro, but biological, is that life on Earth, all life on Earth, shares a common ancestor. Now, right there, Christians will say, no, we share a common creator. But they say a common ancestor. Just as you and your cousin share a common grandmother. Now, let's set this up and let's think about this logic. Okay, what are you, your cousins, and a grandmother? Humans. So yes, you can make that connection. But what they're trying to do is take something that is legitimate, connection between humans, and now apply it between humans and other species. They go on to say, through the process of descent with modification, in other words, changes in the genetic structure, the common ancestor of life on Earth gave rise to the fantastic diversity that we see documented in the fossil record all around us. Evolution means that we are all distant cousins. Humans and oak trees, hummingbirds and whales. Now that is just an audacious statement to me. I have seen humans that acted like nuts, and I have seen humans that were as big as whales. But I don't believe that means that we are of the same species or of the same origin. There is a unique creator behind us, but we're not related to one another. Most of this idea was popularized, or at least set in motion. We can't blame it all on Darwin. We can perhaps on his students. But Charles Darwin, lived in the 1800s, and he wrote a very groundbreaking piece of work called On the Origin of Species. He had done this research on the Galapagos Islands, and he had there noticed a group of birds, finches, that some had long beaks, short beaks, other type of features. And he surmised, again, that when a species ended up in a certain location, the survival of that species depended on various characteristics. For instance, if birds had longer beaks, they could reach into a tree hole and pull out a worm. Well, all that's true. But then he and his students later on, primarily his students, went on to suggest that whole species then could change as the environment changes. And as DNA sequences change, they said that species could change. Now, I'm not a biologist, I'm not a scientist per se. You've got some doctors in your audience tonight who know this much better than I. But let's think about mutation. You know, one of the things that the scientists tell us today is that mutation, over time, created a better species and created a better thing from a lower form of life. The problem is everything I've read, and I think this can be substantiated, is that generally a change in DNA sequence leads to a catastrophe, not to something that's better. You ever heard of Down syndrome? Have you ever heard of Huntington's chorea and these other diseases? They are mutations or problems in the genetic code. Well, again, that's, you know, not something that over time is going to lead to a better, higher species. It is impossible, in my view, that this should occur. But again, here's what they're trying to tell you. In the beginning, there was slime and ooze and nothing. No God involved at all. And evolution now has led us to where we are becoming God. That is theistic, humanistic rather, theology.
And then, of course, the Christian kind of looks at it the opposite way. In the beginning, God created and said, it's very good. But over time, we have been leaving God. Ecclesiastes 7:29, God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes. And so again, here's the point that I want you to also understand. Evolution is not a scientific endeavor as much as it is a system of faith. Now, you know, scientists, like religionists, like Christians, have their high priests, they have their churches, they have their documents, they have their Bible, and you have to keep that in mind, that evolution is a system of faith. And by the way, you are going to believe something. You know, it is impossible for the human animal, if you will, use an evolutionary term, the human animal to not believe. You believe something. And so the choice is yours. You can either believe in God or faith, or you can believe in chance. Now, again, for the evolutionists, their God, or at least the power behind their system, is really time. Given enough time, so goes the theory, anything can happen. Now, let's look at this. George Wall. Now, this man is a Nobel laureate. And by the way, until just a couple of years ago, I thought the Nobel Peace Prize was pretty special. And then some folks began to win the Nobel Peace Prize, and I couldn't figure out where. Well, it's a political thing now. It's a political toy. And let's just leave it there. The point is here's a man who's very smart. He was awarded a Peace Prize back when people really fought and did something to get it, to earn it. He says time is in fact the hero of the plot. And he's an evolutionist. He says the time with which we have to deal is in the order of 2 billion years. What we regard as impossible on the basis of human experience is meaningless. Given so much time, the impossible becomes possible, the possible probable, and the probable virtually certain. One only has to wait, and time itself performs the miracles. That is incredible to me. Here is a man who's using theology and Bible talk, miracles, to basically say that time is the power, and given enough time, what cannot possibly occur will occur. You talk about faith. That is a tremendous amount of faith to say that what cannot occur will occur given enough time. You see, time is the hero of the plot. And this kind of brings you back to the little notes that I handed out. But, you know, the old fairy tales used to say that when the princess kissed the frog, instantaneously a prince evolved. Well, evolution really teaches the same thing, just takes a little more time. You, again, add a little time, and the prince arises from a frog. Well, you see, again, evolution looks to me like is really in the same category as your old fairy tales. We don't take fairy tales seriously. We know they're fun and they may teach moral principles, but fairy tale and evolution, again, same genre, it looks to me. Evolution, again, a system of faith. Its God is time. Given enough time, anything is possible. Its Bible is the geologic and fossil records. Evolutionists believe that the geologic table reveals the development of mankind. Its clergy are the scientists, and also those outlets like PBS and other shows on TV. And its salvation is the humanistic advancement of mankind. Man is the center of the universe, and he is the ultimate master. Now, that's everything opposed to what Christians believe. We don't believe that man, it's within man, the walketh to direct his own steps. Now, let me just mention at least two of these. We may buzz through one of them. But what are some real legitimate problems with evolution? One, which I think is insurmountable, is the idea of spontaneous generation. Now, that may be kind of one of those eighth grade science terms that you may have forgotten. But spontaneous generation is the idea that life just appears. I guess we believe in spontaneous generation in the sense that God created life, but we don't believe that something comes from nothing. We always believe that God was. God is, and those that seek Him obviously must take that into consideration. God has always existed. He is the ever-existent one. He is the I Am, is what I'm trying to say. But spontaneous generation says that something came from nothing. And that's what has to be true if evolution is true. Life had to come from non-life. Now again, Dr. Wald again. One only has to contemplate the magnitude of this task, in other words, life coming from non-life, to concede that the spontaneous generation of a living organism is impossible. That's a pretty good quote so far. But then he says, yet here we are as a result, I believe, of spontaneous generation. Now, how do you help someone like that, who is brilliant, who is a Nobel Peace Laureate, and yet he says, in spite of the evidence, I'm going to believe something else? By the way, that's probably the way the evolutionists think of us as Christians. But nonetheless, he is saying, there's no evidence for life coming from non-life, and yet, here we are. Well, there have been many recipes for spontaneous generation. In fact, they even have some of them codified. First of all, Aristotle, you know, one of the big three, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle? Aristotle believed that flies came from mud. There's a mud puddle, pretty soon you see flies in it. Mud must be producing flies. Maggots, they believe, came from decaying meat. Throw a piece of meat out there, and pretty soon there's maggots on it. Maggots must be coming from your steak. Rats, they believe, came from old rags. In fact, a man by the name of John Baptista von Helmont came up with a recipe for rats. You want some mice? Need something to feed your boa constrictor, your python, or something for your table? He says, place a dirty shirt or some rags in an open pot or barrel containing a few grains of wheat and some wheat bran, and in 21 days, mice will appear. There will be adult males and females present, and they will be capable of mating and reproducing more mice. Well, now, that's absurd. But that was something that was believed back in the 1600s. That is life from non-life. We know that cannot happen. In fact, Louis Pasteur, you go to the milk, or you go to the store and buy your milk, it's pasteurized. It comes from the name Louis Pasteur. In other words, when you heat something and kill the germs and you seal it, no germs will grow because there's nothing in there. Nothing comes from nothing, and nothing ever could. And so then, again, even science has proved that spontaneous generation cannot occur. Let me address very quickly the fossil record because, again, this is a whole other field of study and one which gets very complicated very quickly. But, you know, the fossil record is supposedly this record of how creatures evolved up to where we are today. And of course, every once in a while, you'll find somebody purporting to have found some missing link or some new fossil. In fact, just long ago, it was Ardi. Remember Ardi? I don't know if you saw that, but it was supposed to be this new hominid that outdated Lucy by about 2 billion years. But anyway, the idea here is that the fossil record displays and shows and proves evolution. I don't believe it does. But let's talk about how fossils are formed. How are fossils formed? You know, I used to love to hunt fossils when I was a kid. You'll see them in creek beds and things. Well, fossils are the remnants of animals and creatures left over who have been quickly covered up and buried by silt and sand. And then gradually, where that animal was or that creature, the minerals fill in the gap after the body decays, leaving a hard, calcified fossil. And of course, that's what scientists then use as something to determine the record of the history of Earth. And supposedly, when you look at fossils, again, they give us an accurate history of the Earth's core and the Earth's creation, or the Earth's evolvement. Well, here's the problem, I think. You know, when we look at the fossil record, scientists say that the fossil record demonstrates these billions of years in which things evolve. Now, the problem with that is that fossils don't occur or are not created over a long period of time. In other words, they are caused when something happens very quickly and catastrophically that buries them. And so really, when you think about the model of what you see, for instance, when you look at the Grand Canyon, you know, we were at the Grand Canyon a few weeks ago, my wife and I, as we came back from California, and there are all these layers. Now, the evolutionists will say these layers were laid down very slowly over billions of years. Well, again, if they were laid down very slowly, there should be no fossils, because fossils require immediate covering. It requires catastrophism to cover up animals and then, again, create fossils. But I think a better explanation of all these layers we're seeing even around the Earth is there was some catastrophe, like, if not the, flood of Noah. You know, the Bible tells us that the fountains of the deep broke up and the world was flooded. And that pictures perfectly what we find with fossils, where animals are piled one up on top of another and very quickly buried, and then, of course, they fossilize and we have their remains today. Well, catastrophism, I think, is a much better way to explain the fossil record than it is to say, for example, the Grand Canyon occurred over billions of years. By the way, when we think of the fossil record, you know, there's some problems with it. First of all, the fossil record, if it's really true, should have many transitional links. We don't find them. We find some things that are purported to be transitional links, but they're really not. And there also, of course, should be a unique, direct layers that we find anywhere in the world that accord with one another, and that's not true either. There's no place in the world where the geologic column, as it is called, can be found in every layer. We'll get to that in a second if we have time. The fossil record, though, what about the missing link? You know, for years, we've heard scientists say they were searching for the missing link. In other words, something that would prove a transition between species A and species B. And of course, they've never found it. They found things they would like to pass off as that. For example, there's a bird called Archaeopteryx, and this is supposed to be the missing link between birds and reptiles. In other words, lizards and birds, supposedly came from the same background. Well, the problem is when you study this, even the paleontologists will tell you it has feathers like a bird, wings like a bird, teeth like some extinct birds, has claws like a bird. In other words, again, you know, if it walks like a duck, talks like a duck, looks like a duck, probably a duck. It's a bird. And even evolutionists or paleontologists state that. Well, other missing links. Neanderthal man, again, was for a time purported to be a missing link. And now it's just believed that these individuals were just people with deformities from rickets. Piltdown man was at one time declared to be 500,000 years old. He was found, and by the way, it was found later on that it was a hoax. Somebody had taken a human skull and doctored it and purported it as a hoax. Nebraska man, based on one tooth discovered from an extinct pig, and yet a whole history was built around Nebraska man and other of these creatures. And by the way, Artie, I was reading last night, no, this morning, on Artie, you know, Artie's bones, who was this new supposed link, was found over a period of years, over a period of areas that had been so trampled they had to actually use sophisticated equipment to tease out what they think that these bones initially look like. And then they had to combine what those bones they think look like with an existing skull to come up now with this whole theory of Artie. You see, you just can't pay attention seriously many times to the whole idea of the geologic table and fossils and all that. Well, let's move on. I want to close down here pretty quick. But what about dinosaurs? You know, I mentioned to one of the kids back in the back, we're going to talk about dinosaurs, maybe asleep now, but that's okay. Dinosaurs, did they exist? I mean, they're one of our calling cards for getting our kids involved in evolution. Well, yeah, I believe they did exist. Now, some interesting things about dinosaurs. First of all, they supposedly lived 65 million years ago during the Mesozoic era. And we always think of dinosaurs as being huge. But, you know, scientists tell us that the average size of a dinosaur is probably that of a sheep. And, you know, we still have animals today, reptiles, that fit the classification of a dinosaur. For example, we have the Komodo dragon. That is a dinosaur by all standards of literature and of history and science. It is a terrible lizard. And so, you know, we still have animals today that could be classified as dinosaurs. Now, it's true, the bigger ones seem to have gone extinct. Every once in a while you hear about Loch Ness Monster or something like that. But the bigger ones have gone extinct, just like many big species have, and I believe probably due to environmental changes and man killing them. But nonetheless, dinosaurs did exist. In fact, we have cave paintings. We have ancient stories and traditions that connect man with these big lizard creatures, which again, we would call dinosaurs today. The term dinosaur, again, wasn't even coined until recent era. It's just simply a way to say this big creature lived with man. In fact, in Texas, down in the Paluxy River, there is dinosaur prints and human prints in the same strata. So again, humans and dinosaurs did live simultaneously. Well, the Bible, does it speak of dinosaurs? Well, maybe, we're not sure. In Job, and by the way, the book of Job is believed to have been set or written during the patriarchal age, which would have been way back toward the beginning of time. But Job mentions a couple of creatures that sound a lot like dinosaurs. He mentions one called Behemoth. He says, again, he eats grass like an ox. See how his strength is in his hips and his power is in his stomach muscles. He moves his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are tightly knit. His bones are like beams of bronze. His ribs like bars of iron. Now, some people say, well, that's an alligator or something else. But, you know, it sounds to me a lot like a dinosaur. In other words, I believe that in the Bible times, there were creatures out there who people today would call dinosaurs. Leviathan. Job also mentions Leviathan, this creature of the sea. Sneezes forth lightning, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. You know, again, it's just out of his nostrils, he says, go smoke. The way he describes this is, again, like a dinosaur. And so, again, you know, even today, once in a while, something will be dredged up off the bottom of the ocean that we've never seen before. First of all, we don't even know what's still in our universe, in our seas, in our world. But second of all, it is obvious that species have gone extinct. We have no reason to deny dinosaurs, because I believe they exist. There are fossil evidence that they existed, but not millions of years ago. Well, as we conclude, is there any evidence for God? You know, basically what we've done up to this point is we've chipped away at the problems of evolution. But is there any evidence for God? Now, the Bible asserts there is. Psalm 19:1, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork. And then, of course, Hebrews chapter 3, verse 4, indirectly kind of points to God when it says that every house is built by someone, but he who built all things is God. In other words, you can't have a structure with having a creator. Everything came from something. There was a source that is behind everything on this earth. Well, let me give you a couple of arguments. One is the teleological argument. That's kind of fancy. If you can't remember that, just remember the watchmaker or designer argument. You know, if you're out walking in the desert, and you find a watch, and you reach down, you pick that up, and it is keeping perfect time, and it's just a beautiful specimen of a Swiss watch, you don't assume that that just occurred. You don't assume that the pieces blew in there on a sandstorm, and that watch just began to tick. Well, a man by the name of William Paley came up with this argument. It's really just common sense, but it's called the teleological argument, or the design argument. And the point is this: that design requires a designer. Now, this is interesting, I think, and I want to focus on this slide just for a second. You know, when we look, for instance, at the bones of various creatures, such as a mammal or a cat or a whale or a bat, you see similarities. First of all, they're made of calcium. They've got digits on them. And depending on their environment, whether it's air or sea or land, they are similar but yet different. And some would say what this detects points to is an evolutionary process. Now, I'm going to come along and say no. What it points to is a common designer. You know, I love to look at museum art. And when I go into an art or a museum, I can immediately pick out the Rembrandts. I love Rembrandt. Why? Because his coloring is the same. His features are the same. He has this foreboding darkness in all of his paintings, or in most of them. He has a style. He has a whole school that's evolved around his style. You can tell a Rembrandt. You can tell a Monet. You can tell a Van Gogh. He was very disturbed, and you can see it in his paintings. You see, when an artist creates something, there are going to be similarities between what he creates now and what he creates later. The same is true in the 6 days of creation. There is similarity between what God created on each of those days of creation. There is a common designer. It does not point to evolution. You know, the human body is so intricately created. The average human brain has 100 billion nerve cells. 50,000 of the cells in your body will die and be replaced by the time you read that sentence. 1 square inch of your skin, there are 4 yards of nerve fibers. 1,300 cells, 100 sweat glands. We can go on and on. Our bodies are recreating themselves every 3 months. Some of us faster than others. But we get new skin every month. Again, all of this by accident? No. It takes, shall I say it in a kind way, a fool to say in his heart, there is no God. Well, let me give you another argument, and that is, we've already said, the cosmological argument, which says that everything had to have a source. Nothing comes from nothing. The Bible traces it back to God. The evolutionists back to the Big Bang. What beyond that? You see, ultimately, everyone has faith. It comes back to faith at some point. You believe that which you cannot prove. So you have a choice. God or science. Well, what would life without God be? You know, think about that. Think about, first of all, what life in our culture would be without Christ. Now, we're trying to expunge Christ from everything in our culture, Christianity, in our culture today. What would it be without Christ? What would it be without God? Can you imagine? I mean, life's pretty terrible at times, even with God, even with religion. What about life without God? You know, you think about the Holocaust, one of the most terrible times of our planet in modern days, when, extermination by Hitler of the Jews. There was a Jewish scholar named Edward Simon. Here's what he says, very interesting. He says, I don't claim that Darwin, by the way, Hitler was an evolutionist, as was Stalin and others. He says, I don't claim that Darwin and his theory of evolution brought on the Holocaust. In other words, he's not going to blame it directly on Darwin. But, he says, I cannot deny that the theory of evolution and the atheism it engendered led to the moral climate that made Holocaust possible. That's a very interesting statement. Now, this man's Jewish. He's looking back on his own people. He says, I'm not going to say that evolution directly caused the Holocaust, but it created an environment where life was not worth anything because, logically speaking, if evolution is true, then some of us are more important than others. And it's okay, then, to get rid of some by others. Well, think about this. If evolution is true, then there's no ultimate authority but man. There's no God. Man is the ultimate authority. And if evolution is true, there is racism. You know, we spend so much time combating racism. Why? If evolution is true, we talk out both sides of our mouth in the science community. If indeed evolution is true, there is a superior race. And by the way, it's probably those that came from Africa, because that's where they believe it all started. There's no equality. But you know, by the way, God did not create race. God created from all man one blood, created man from one blood, according to Acts 17. Number three, there's no morality or ethics outside of man. In other words, don't go to the Bible to try to prove you're right. Just decide yourself. And then number four, if evolution really is true, then the weak and the helpless are expendable, and that not only expendable, but they should be gotten rid of. You know, I am amazed sometimes, and very heartened, obviously, by various organizations that go out there and try to help other people, and altruistic organizations, and even organizations that I totally disagree with, like the Shriners. You know, they have their burn units in their hospitals. We do all this stuff for each other, and when there's a crisis, in fact, America, by the way, in spite of the fact that they're hated all over the world, sends more grain to folks that we disagree with than any other nation. But, you know, in reality, if evolution really is true, we ought to circle the wagons, keep it all at home, let the dying and the sick die because they're just going to reproduce, and, again, be a stronger survival of the fittest. Well, we know that doesn't make sense. That goes against the very nature of our feelings about who we are and the value of human life, which, by the way, is being chipped away as well. Well, if evolution is true, there's no judgment, there's no afterlife, and there's no hope. You truly are a fluke, a mistake of the universe. No wonder our kids grow up with this pessimistic attitude about culture and life and values because they've been taught, well, life just happened anyway. There's no ultimate purpose. So, man, get all the gusto and then live the way you want. Well, that's the bloodstained legacy of evolution right there. Marx, Stalin, Hitler, you can go on and on. But again, here is the final slide, and that is, with God, again, the implications of evolution. With God, all things are possible. But without God, all things are permissible. That's a scary thought. All things being permissible. Well, in conclusion, know some facts. You don't have to know everything. One of the biggest myths is that you have to know everything before you stand for your faith. No. Stand for your faith. Share your faith. Don't be intimidated. Don't compromise. And guess what? You won't be around and I won't be around. But the science that they are trying to cram down your throat now will change in 100 years. I guarantee it. It's even changed in my lifetime. You realize at one time, not long ago, they were saying the world was getting cold. Now they're saying it's going to burn up. They can't make up their minds. Science changes. So stand for what you know is tried and true.
Well, those are the thoughts tonight, and again, because of the lateness, I don't think we'll open up for questions, but I'll let Smith, it ain't Smith, it's Clint. I'll let Clint Bibbins, I'll let you close out the service. Thanks you very much.